This would be Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. He joins us every Monday at about 1 o'clock. He's co-founder of the 10-Point Coalition. He's chair of something called Boston's Youth Violence Reduction Task Force. And most importantly, he's kind enough to get himself on page one of the Herald just in time for his appearance here today. Welcome, Reverend Eugene Franklin Rivers III. How are you, Reverend?
Hello, good people. How are you doing?
Great. Good to talk to you.
We're doing very well, Reverend. And I have to say, it was a fetching photograph of you on the front page of the Herald today.
It was a good
I mean,
one.
You look like you're about 30 years old there in that picture.
Well, thank God for the miracles of the time. Okay. Photographic technology.
So you were talking in the piece in the Herald this morning about something called a setup girl.
Yeah.
What's that?
What has evolved, the brief version is, what has evolved over the last few years has been frequently black teenage girls getting involved and functioning as spies and what they call setup chicks to lure young men that are drug dealers to get them kidnapped. And that there's this off-the-books business where, number one, in Boston, there's been a growing cottage industry of kidnapping for ransom, where drug dealers, you know, a skunk kidnaps a gorilla, right? So you got skunk one who kidnaps skunk two, who's a drug dealer, and, you know, they're both criminals, right? So none of this off the books. And so there's this cottage industry that exists in the black community. It's not new to the black community. You watch any of the old gangster movies, this stuff happened. But we now have it happening with growing frequency among young black girls that get caught up in this game. And much of this was associated with the tragic murder of the three girls on Harlem Street in August of last year.
In the car.
Right.
Well, you talk about something that was new to me, is that some of these young women that will agree to get paid or 100 to 200 bucks a pop or something like that to go lure a young kid to some public place or place where they can – the girl will tell the other rival gang people – and the rival gang people will come and beat or even torture somebody?
Kidnap the people for ransom. This it's very, when you think about underground economies, right? You got these drug dealers. They're making lots of cash. It's illegal cash. And the economy's tight. Things are tough. I see this guy over here driving a fancy car. Could somebody check him out, find out what he's doing? They know he's a drug dealer. You kidnap him. Stick him in the trunk of a car and tell, you know, Cornbread and Chewy, tell his people for $10,000, we'll get him back in one piece.
What happens to the young woman, even if she's lucky enough to get $100 or $200, what happens when that one gang member who she's sort of hung out with, and then all of a sudden it's pretty clear that the reason they knew where he was to go after him was because of that so-called setup girl. What happens to these young women?
She can get killed. And it is common knowledge on the street, I need to qualify that, common knowledge on the street that one of the girls that was murdered.
There were four girls in the car, right?
Four girls
and
in the car.
And three killed.
Three killed.
That was awful.
Yeah, you know, it was terrible, right? And
wait, common knowledge, finish the sentence.
Common it was common knowledge that one of the girls was in the game, and one of her victims caught up with her, and they hunted her down, and she was executed. And then there couldn't be any witnesses, and it was just a mistake that there weren't four fatalities as opposed to three.
And they were just sitting in a car on the street and gunned down right in the car. It was just brutal. It was incredible.
Yeah, and very, very nasty game. And it's growing with frequency. And my concern is, since it's off the books, you know, it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. So you have this terrible thing going on in the black community. And if it starts in the black community, it's coming to a suburb near you. Have you guys seen this new movie that's coming out called Spring Breaker?
No.
There was an amazing 5-page review about, you know, these bad acting girls that are getting involved in this stuff during spring break. So my point is that there is a coarseness about the culture, and there's this glamorization of thug life that now involves young women, and because it's off the books, it gets underreported.
When you say glamorization, though, my sense is, well, Marjorie and I both mentioned the 100, 200 bucks is mentioned in the front page Herald story. I assume sometimes the young woman doesn't have a choice. It isn't like she says, well, I think I want to make 200 bucks today. I'm willing to take the risk.
Sure.
In some of these cases, these young kids are told to go do this
Absolutely.
Or else, right?
Absolutely. And see, the thing that brought it to my attention Right after this, the incident happened in 10:30 on a Sunday night in August. By 9:30 the next morning, right, it was on the street. It was on the wire. I sit down at Dunkin' Donuts in Fields Corner, and I talk to one of these kids I helped out 20 years ago. Well, Reverend Rivers, you haven't heard it from me, man, but that was a setup chick, man. She's playing with fire. And so it was amazing. And so it was all in 24 hours, everybody in the hood knew what had happened on Harlem Street, right?
Wow.
And so it's tough. It's a tough story. And I want to thank the Boston Herald for getting it out here.
Marjorie works for the Herald, too.
I do.
So she's very pleased. Hey, can we go from Fields Corner to the Sistine Chapel?
Sure, absolutely.
Do you have a relationship with Cardinal and, according to some odds makers, future Pope Sean O'Malley? Do you have a relationship with him?
No, listen. I have had the honor of working with Cardinal Sean O'Malley since he took office.
Well, what kinds of things? I didn't know. What
One of the most recent thing is that I, with Reverend Brown and other black clergy, Jeff Brown, worked on the physician-assisted suicide vote. And
the ballot question last November.
The ballot
right.
question, right, on euthanasia.
Yeah.
And, you know, it doesn't come terribly as a surprise that the black church dudes didn't want people killing their grandmama.
Yeah. Have you seen, speaking of movies, Reverend Rivers, have you seen that movie, Amour? It was up for a bunch of Academy Awards.
You know what? I was supposed to see that with
the wife. Well, you should go see that. You know why?
Uh-huh.
Because after you see that movie about this woman's last days on earth, you're going to change your mind about assisted suicide.
You know,
all I'm thinking about watching that movie is I want my pills to get out of this. I mean, this poor woman was tortured in her last days.
Sure.
You know, we could be in that situation pretty
one day.
Soon, right?
Yeah,
Reverend.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm
but talk about O'Malley. What's he like to work with?
I want a way out.
What's he like as a person? Do you think, and be candid about this, does he have what it takes to be the leader of 1.2 billion people?
Let me start with that last question first,
yeah.
Right? You know, listen, you know, this is Boston. So there's all kinds of hype. And so, you know, our local boxers are going to be world champions. No, they're not.
The Italian newspaper. We're going to talk to a reporter for an Italian news agency in about 10 minutes or 15 minutes.
Sure.
Italian newspapers, some are saying he is the odds-on favorite. It's not the Dorchester Reporter. It's not the Globe. It's not the Herald.
I find that amazing.
He's Italian news. Well, so put that aside for a second.
Sure.
What are his – I mean, I don't know him from a hole in the wall.
No, multilingual.
Multilingual because they're all multilingual.
Yeah.
He's multilingual. Much of his ministry, South Central America, wearing the robe. As I said, you know, I mean, he's the kind of low-key personality who's much more comfortable, you know, serving the sacraments as some Mapuche Indians up in the Andes Mountains somewhere, right? He's not really a city person. I have to say this, right, because it concerns me, right? He does not have, in the black community, the presence that Cardinal Bernie Law had. Bernie Law was all over Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan all the time. And you could speed dial and get to Bernie Law. Cardinal O'Malley is a different style. He's not accessible in the way that Cardinal Bernie Law was.
Well, how much of Roxbury, Dorchester, and Mattapan is Catholic anymore? When I think of blacks in Catholic Church, I think of Caribbean blacks, you know,
sure,
the Haitians.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's not many African Americans that are Catholic, are there?
Well, no. But
kind
see,
of a dull mass.
Yeah.
For,
well, I'll tell you what's interesting about
the black
that.
Church, which
actually,
is much more fun.
I'll tell you what. I went to St. John St. Hugh's on a Sunday afternoon, and the Nigerians were up in there, and child, it was rocking and popping.
Really?
Oh, it was a Pentecostal charismatic service, and they just happened to be Catholic.
So the Africans recently from Africa are much more Catholic.
Oh, no, they're Catholic. You got you have the Haitians.
Yeah.
You got the Cape Verdeans.
Yeah.
You have the Nigerians. And so you have a lot of your Francophone countries, they're Catholics.
Yeah.
They
come here. Okay, can I get back to O'Malley for a second?
Yes,
you guys
are
talking philosophical. I want to talk about O'Malley, and this is not to disparage him, but you have a relationship with him. You've seen him operate. You worked with him on this ballot campaign.
Yes.
That sort of thing. And virtually everybody who knows him well describes him like you do. He's a fairly private person, not comfortable. So have you seen qualities that would suggest to you that he could walk out after the white smoke comes out and be essentially one of the most important leaders in the world and probably one of the most important people who has ever come out of Boston? I mean, as one of our colleagues said this morning, it would be like JFK and Sean O'Malley in the history books should this guy become Pope.
Well, no, frankly, I would be completely amazed. And the backstory would be the first thing I'd want to know because it doesn't fit for me. There are too many alpha personalities that are dynamic. I mean, why Sean O'Malley over Timothy Dolan?
New York City New York. Cardinal.
Whoa. I mean, Dolan comes in. He sucks the air out of the room. He's sharp as a
tack. He's funny.
He's funny. I mean, because I've been in a number of meetings with Dolan, right? Cardinal Dolan. Sharp. And he's a real and he's a strong leader. One doesn't get that sense. So I'm, you know, some Italian guys are handicapping it that way. That would be completely counterintuitive for everybody
I
know.
Much, he is much more charismatic. But on the other hand, maybe they're looking for someone who's not a showman. And maybe he's widely viewed, although lots of local people here don't think so, and SNAP, the Survivors Network, doesn't think so, but lots of local people here criticize him on the church sex abuse cleanup. He's widely viewed elsewhere as being pretty good on the church sex abuse cleanup, a reformer, in other words.
But he's not a strong leader. You don't have to be loud or charismatic. You have to be Dolan.
Yeah.
But you got to be strong. I mean, listen, you're dealing with some tough characters. Right? So my sense is, I mean— John Paul, strong man. He's a strong man. Strong, charismatic figure, rock star. But in addition to all that, strong man and a real intense intellectual. That's number one. Number two, same thing with Ratzinger. These are both strong guys. They're not loud. They're not flashy, but they're strong. And Cardinal O'Malley's style. He's sort of reclusive. The handshake's not one that is memorable.
I've never shaken his hand. What's his like? What's it like to shake his hand?
Yeah. Well, most people can't see that radio.
That's like a soft shoe.
You know what?
You're saying he's not a leader, is what you're saying, right?
He doesn't project that leadership thing, not at all. And in fact, I'll tell you what's funny. In terms of handshakes, he had a handshake that reminded me of Barack Obama's handshake.
Does he have a soft shoe handshake?
Don't destroy Marjorie's image.
Barack Obama's a soft shoe. Ah. Oh,
thank goodness there are no cameras in here.
That's really awful. Okay, we have to move on to something else. A provocative argument that you've made that post-Obama's election and maybe even post-Deval Patrick's election in Boston, in Massachusetts, two African-American guys, that race matters less in politics. Now, make your case.
My case is very simple. We have drunk the Kool-Aid of the first black president.
America or black America?
Well, black America. You'll love this, right? Black America has had a unilateral love affair with these very pretty black elected officials. You've got a perfectly coiffed Obama with the even more perfect wife, right? Because black America, I mean, I imagine 30% of black America voted for Obama based on Michelle.
Yeah,
okay?
She's great.
Well, yeah, she's great.
The arms.
So my sense is that, you've had this unilateral love affair with Obama. Black America just loved Obama because he was the son all these grandmothers wish they had.
When you say unilateral, you mean they love him, but he doesn't love them in return? Is that your point?
Yeah, that's my point.
Because he hasn't delivered the goods.
No.
Is that what you're saying?
No. What I'm saying is this. Now, you're going to love it. This is actually very good. You have to, right?
We'll be the judge of that.
You know, see, Barack Obama is really sort of like Michael Corleone. And there's this great scene in The Godfather where Frankie Pantangelo, the local provincial from Brooklyn, comes to complain about how he's not looking out for him because he's got to deal with the Rosado brothers and Hyman Roth, right? Well, Michael's relationship to black America is like Michael Corleone's relationship to Frankie Pantangelo.
Barack Obama's relationship to black America.
Yeah. No, where he says, listen, I'm busy doing big things. Of course you're family, but I want you to go back to Brooklyn, mind your manners, and leave Hyman Roth alone. I've got stuff to get done. Well, that's basically Barack Obama's relation to black America, right? Black America loves him in essentially a unilateral way. And Barack Obama is this brilliant, cerebral, very intellectual, not a touchy-feely kind of guy who embodies, this irresistible image of a black man.
But I understand, but let me be clear about this. When you keep saying unilateral, is that because you think that a black president is not focused on doing things for black Americans or because he doesn't talk the talk? Because it seems to me, I was reading a couple of pieces over the weekend about this, and it seems to me that when you have Deval Patrick doesn't talk a huge amount about it either. However, he doesn't have to, nor
Absolutely.
Does Barack Obama.
I agree.
I think most people know Deval Patrick is black.
Right.
He's going to be here Thursday at noon,
sure.
by the way. Barack Obama is black. So I don't think that's – you don't have to talk the talk. You have to walk the walk.
No,
suggesting Obama doesn't walk the walk?
No, not at all. In fact, the contrary. You see, I had perfect expectations for Barack Obama. I was completely clear that while we drank a lot of the Kool-Aid and bath water, he's going to be Roosevelt, he's going to be Johnson. That's all nonsense. That none of that was true. So, no, I have
most
no
important clue. Piece of social legislation, whether you love it or hate it,
absolutely.
Is the Affordable Care Act. What do you mean he didn't? I mean, how can you say, even if you hate the Affordable
didn't do
Care?
For, enough for Black America, but if, I don't think he could do that much for Black America.
No, he couldn't.
Because it can't be the black president.
Well, let's make it local for a second. There's a race in South Boston.
Yes.
There are, as far as I know, there are three candidates.
Okay.
There's a white woman by the name of Maureen Dayhill, who's from South Boston.
She's a blogger.
She has this great blog.
Yeah.
Caught Up in Southie, I think it's called. It's great. Yep. She's taking leave from that.
Sure.
There is Nick Collins, who's a state rep from there, also white.
Yeah.
And there is Linda Dorsina Forey, who's a Haitian American, who's with us a couple of days ago, who is not from South Boston, who's running. So, where are you on where African Americans...
Black America's relationships have to be transactional. Listen, we do business. It's the great line. Sorry to come back to the Godfather thing.
That's fine.
Nothing personal but business.
I think you should have been a movie critic.
No, no. No, when you look at the town, it's all about transitional stuff. Think about it this way. 30 years after Mel King's race, which was a protest candidacy, right?
I mean,
we were all here, right?
1983.
Right, 83. The game has changed. In other words, people are using an 8-track tape in an iPad world in terms of their model and thinking about politics. We're off the 8-track tape now. If you're not engaged in transactional interaction, so when we go to this race, listen, in fact, I'm meeting with Nick Collins this afternoon at 3:30, and all I want to talk to him about is business. With Linda... Linda Dorsina Forey, what have you done? What have you produced by way of product?
So you're saying if African Americans in this South—I shouldn't call it South Boston district because it's only 25% of the district—in Jack Hart's former district,
yes,
part of which is South Boston, if African Americans in the district decided that Nick Collins, or Maureen Dayhill, can do more to make their lives better,
yes,
than Linda Dorsina Forey is able to convince them, she doesn't get the black vote.
She shouldn't.
I'm not saying she should or shouldn't.
Okay. But look at Tom Menino. What you hear about Tom Menino all the time, if you live in Dorchester or Madison, parks are better.
Yes.
You know, things look better. I
absolutely.
Mean, 25 years ago,
yes,
the parks in South Boston were great. Every place else, the parks were lousy. They've done so much in terms of just improvement of the neighborhoods.
Yeah, but he also was run against black. So we were saying, we had November was the election.
Yes.
What percentage of African Americans in this country voted for Obama?
Like 90,000%.
Okay. What has happened since November was the 3rd or 6th? What happened since then? It's now December, January, 3 months later, four months later.
Yeah.
What has happened that causes you to believe that there's been this seismic shift
and how the black voter
sees his or her candidates?
Well, no. What I'm saying is this. Black people, let me explain the difference. First of all, you made the argument. Barack Obama has delivered and acquitted himself brilliantly. He's been a brilliant performer as president. You know, I mean, given the opposition that this man had, he has done a brilliant job by every conceivable estimate, right? He's smart.
He should have schmoozed more.
Well, he's schmoozing now, but go ahead.
Right. And so he's done a brilliant job. Now, is he a touchy-feely guy? Is he a backslapping guy? Is he a put the mayor in my car, we'll ride out to the event together kind of guy? He's none of that. He's a cerebral intellectual. And get this. He would have to be. The first black dude who was president was going to have to be cerebral, above the air. He couldn't hang out with brothers too much. Oh, no.
You mean you, in other words, wouldn't be the first black president?
No, I'm not going to be the president. I'm going to be
president
of Hood.
You're still not answering my question. Okay. Is if it one must assume that a decent percentage of the overwhelming support that Barack Obama got in the black community, a significant percentage was because African Americans thought he delivered.
Yes.
And a significant percentage, I don't know what it is,
were
because we think it's important to have somebody who's a black person in this country to lead this country.
Image, rhetoric, model.
Why has that changed, according to you? Just picking this one race is you're basically saying people, it's a business transaction.
I'll tell you why. I'll tell you what the difference is. Black America is smart enough. Because think of it this way. Jesse Jackson ran for president. Not. Al Sharpton ran for president. Not. And it was not until...
To even mention Al Sharpton in the same breath.
Okay, exactly. But that's my point.
Nausea, but
No, but I just want to make my point.
I got the point.
Sharpton and Jackson, big black talk, not. And it wasn't until Bubba Clinton messed up. You know, and South Carolina.
All right. Same Jesse Jackson won South Carolina, too.
Look, I was a Clinton person. And when Bubba messed up in South Carolina, he made it impossible for black people to support his wife. I remember talking with a bishop of a 6 million member denomination, and Rivers, man, we can't mess with him now, man. Bubba done messed up. We can't do it, Rivers. He says, even if I wanted to vote for the girl, right, I can't vote for it now, right? So what I'm saying is that black America is very shrewd. And what Obama did does not logically and naturally transfer to other black candidates, which is why we didn't vote for Jesse and we didn't vote for Al Sharpton.
Okay, we have been talking with the Reverend Eugene Rivers, who, if you haven't seen it, he has a fetching, as I said before, really gorgeous picture on the front page of the Boston Herald today. He's with us on Mondays at 1 o'clock. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Charlie Baker. Up next, we are dropping in on the Vatican. We've got a reporter live over there for the latest news surrounding the papal enclave. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.